A back cover endorsement of your book by the Dean of Harvard College states that health was a cornerstone of Black Panther politics. Please take us back 40 years and give us some evidence for this remarkable statement.
Yes, you're referring to a very kind comment from the historian Evelyn Hammonds. One can certainly say that healthcare issues were a cornerstone of the Black Panther Party by 1970. And this year, the co-founder of the party, Bobby Seale, sent out a mandate to all of the chapters saying that all chapters had to have not only a free breakfast for children program, which people are more familiar with, and not only had to be distributing the Black Panther newspaper, but they also had to have health clinics. So I wouldn't say that it was the most important part of the Black Panther's politics, you know, but it was certainly, in particular by 1970, a very important and significant part of the Black Panther Party's politics. By 1972, you see there's a change in the Black Panther Party's iconic 10-point platform. So initially, their first 10-point platform is October 1966, and in this 10-point platform, they say that they're engaged in wanting social welfare things for poor and oppressed communities, so bread and land and justice and housing and clothing and these sorts of things. In March of 1972, the 10-point platform is amended and a new point 6 is added that expressly demands free health care for all Black and oppressed people. So, you know, you see over time as the party evolves as an organization that health care goes from being always part of the seedbed of what the party was interested in and engaged in to being an explicit articulation of its politics.
There was obviously a consciousness that Black people were generally not served well by the public health system or by the medical system. Do you have any statistics for the 1960s and 70s of what the discrepancy was?
Well, we didn't have in the 1960s and 70s all of this literature on racial health disparities that we have now in which people could sort of precisely say what the differences were. But two things we do know. One, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, in fact, the 1970 census, less than 5% of all physicians and nurses are African American. So to the extent that we could measure African American health care based on the proportion of health care resources that might be available in Black communities at a moment that we're just coming out of formal segregation, then there were very limited sources in Black communities. And secondly, part of what the Panthers' work is about is the early days, you know, 40 years ago, of really identifying what we now know as racial health disparities. So part of their engagement and intervention into sickle cell anemia, which is a genetic disease that disproportionately affects people of African descent, was that they raised the issue that genetic diseases that affect other communities that are more common in, say, white ethnic communities were receiving a lot more money and attention from the National Institutes of Health, and we're also receiving a lot more public support vis-a-vis philanthropies and these sorts of things. So part of what the Panthers were doing were taking these sorts of statistics and disparities and using them as a mobilizing tool to show how poor Black communities were being left behind with regard to health care resources. And there was also a general awareness of a lack of health care access for Black communities that comes out of a longer history of medical discrimination in the history of Jim Crow in the United States. Jim Crow also operated on a health care register and a medical register. So you had segregated hospitals and you had very poor quality care for African Americans. So we have to understand the Black Panthers' work as an attempt to stand in the gap and to address this lack of health care access, but to do so in a way that asserted that health care was a right and that the lack of access was because the federal government and American politicians, insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies were putting profit motives above the right to health care for all people.
So naturally you interviewed former Black Panthers who participated in the establishment and maintenance of people's free medical clinics in poor neighborhoods. Tell us who they were and what their experience was, also how well those clinics functioned.
That's a great question. So some of them functioned really well and some of them barely functioned, and that was partly because after this 1970 mandate from the headquarters comes down saying that all chapters have to have clinics, not a lot of resources are provided by the Panther leadership to get these clinics going. And so they were very much grassroots institutions, and people had to pull together local resources, both their social networks and the other activists they were allied with, as well as financial resources. So some of these people were a woman named Norma Armour, who is a health care activist now in Los Angeles. she started out in the South Central chapter, and she helped to start that clinic in Los Angeles, which was called the Alprentis Bunchy Carter People's Free Medical Clinic, after Bunchy Carter, who was killed in a confrontation with the US organization at UCLA. So Norma worked in the clinic. She did a lot of management of sort of patient files. She would do basic immunizations. They would often do blood pressure, hypertension screenings. They were also often the first line in the community in a place like South Central. If people brought sick children or sick family members to the clinic, the Panthers helped these people to be referred to doctors who they knew, or politicized doctors and nurses, who would then see that these people, particularly in the case people who were underinsured or uninsured, got the care that they needed, even if they didn't have money to pay for it. There were also people like Cleo Silvers, who's a longtime health activist here in New York City. And she was a member both first of the Black Panther Party and had been a VISTA volunteer working in part on healthcare issues. And she would then go on to join the Young Lords organization. And Cleo was part of the Lincoln Hospital struggle, and in Upper Manhattan and in the Bronx, they did door-to-door healthcare screenings. She was part of a group of healthcare activists, both in the Panthers and the Lords, that would go through the community and try to get a sense of what local communities needed, and then to try to mobilize resources around this. And there were also people in Seattle. I talked to a rank-and-file member of the party named Arthur Harrison, who worked in the Seattle clinic with his partner, a woman named Carolyn Downs, who would pass away in 1969. But Harrison and Downs were really the backbone of the Seattle clinic. And again, also at this clinic, they did immunizations, screenings for lead poisoning, for high blood pressure, and they also made referrals. And the clinics were, you know, people did rotations in them, so people might work in the breakfast program at a local church that allowed the Panthers to use their facilities in the morning, and then the clinic hours were often in the afternoon or in the evenings when the doctors and nurses who volunteered with the Panthers could be off of their hospital rotations or their day jobs and come into the clinics. And also they were open at a time where local people were getting off from work and could bring their family members to the Panther clinics.
How would you contrast this community effort with the current healthcare system and how it serves these various communities? And how does the social aspect now interact with the field of medicine, which is more and more considered to be a scientific endeavor or something sort of universal and general rather than socially motivated? Are neighborhood clinics more effective in addressing public health, in your opinion?
Neighborhood clinics are definitely more effective in the sense that they can meet people where they are. And that means that people can talk about the healthcare needs that come up in their day-to-day life and that they make sense in a context of a community and the context of a place, right? So it matters if you live in a place that's highly polluted, that you can go to a healthcare facility that understands the constraints about whether or not you can do exercise in your community on days like today when the temperatures are very high, that understands the particular needs that you have. It's also the case that neighborhood clinics respond to local needs in a particular way that's important. It's also because they're in the neighborhood, people feel more comfortable going there. And that's critically important, and the Panthers really understood that. The woman, Norma Armour, I mentioned to you previously, when I interviewed her, talked to me about growing up in South Central Los Angeles. And even though we don't think of Los Angeles as being a place that was racially segregated in the way that a place like Birmingham, Alabama would have been, for example, she talked about the fact that there were certain places in Los Angeles that you just didn't go. So she said, you know, I never went on the other side of Western Avenue in Los Angeles. And so to have a hospital that was available for her that was all the way on the other side of Los Angeles, like, she just wasn't going to go there. You know, she didn't feel comfortable going to that part of town because that's the way that casual racial segregation, residential segregation worked in the 1970s. And we know that, unfortunately, statistically, in American society today, communities are as racially segregated as they were in some cases in the 1950s and 60s. And so the importance of community clinics and part of their effectiveness is that it's a place where people can feel like they can bring their full selves, that they can feel comfortable and saying, you know, what the issues and their problems are. And part of the issue, particularly with poor communities of color, is that people often don't trust healthcare providers. And there's lots of historical reasons why one might not trust a healthcare provider. And if it's a clinic that you walk by every day on your way to the subway or the bus, that you see the healthcare professionals going in and out, that you know the people that are running it, that means that it's much more likely that you'll trust those clinics. And I think, you know, going back to the Panthers of the story of the 1970s, the clinics were also a model of what appropriate, humane, respectful health care looked like. So part of the issue with health care access in the 60s and 70s was about, like today, strictly the issue of access. Do you have Medicare? Do you have Medicaid? Do you have insurance? Can you afford to go and see a doctor? But the Panthers were also interested in how people were treated, right? So they wrote a lot in their newspaper, and the people that I interviewed talked about, you know, doctors being disrespectful or being dismissive of poor patients or patients of color. And so part of what the Black Panthers example of a community clinic provided was, you know, an example of, you know, this wonderful phrase that another world is possible. The Black Panther clinics were quite literally, you know, in practice, another example of how healthcare could be provided, another way of how a healthcare system could look. And with regard to the question about, you know, the social aspects of their care, you know, I'd say that the Black Panther Party was committed to having the best possible medical options for poor communities of color. So they weren't anti-science or anti-medicine, but they understood that health was, you know, part of a larger social matrix. So that health, whether or not one could be healthy, whether or not one could have well-being, was related to issues of class inequality and racism in American society. So the social for the Black Panther Party, particularly in their clinics, I think was not necessarily in contrast to the scientific, but it was understanding that the scientific sort of exists within this larger matrix of the social.
And finally, President Obama's health care reform law received the green light, or seems to have received the green light, from the Supreme Court this past week. What are your thoughts about the future of socialized medicines in this new context?
The Affordable Care Act is, at its core, a mix of public and private insurance. So I think it's really, you know, for those of us like me who think that we should have universal health care, it's an uneven development. So anywhere from 30 to 32 million more people have been covered, and this is, of course, a very good thing. It's also a good thing that in a political climate in which President Obama's every move has been thwarted, he was able to accomplish what presidents had tried before him to do and never succeeded at doing. So, you know, this is a victory, and as critical as you know, some may be of President Obama, you know, in the face of you know, his presidential candidate like Mitt Romney, who wants to repeal even these modest gains that got the green light this past week, you know, it's important to be clear about what President Obama and Nancy Pelosi and others accomplished under really hostile conditions. So in that regard, you know, I do want to say that it's a signal achievement. But it's also the case that health insurance doesn't equal the end to health inequality. So, you know, we want to be careful in the same way that the election of President Obama didn't usher in a post-racial society by any stretch of the imagination. It's also true that the Affordable Care Act will not be the end of health inequality in American society. So we had, before the Affordable Care Act was passed, estimated anywhere from 45 to 50 million people who were either uninsured or underinsured. So the passage, or you know, the green lighting of the Affordable Care Act means still that there are 15 to 20 million people who don't have access to health care insurance. And moreover, the Affordable Care Act has expanded Medicaid, which is a fantastic thing, but it leaves this expansion up to the states. And so, you know, it's going to, I think, take a lot of doing and cajoling to get particularly stubborn Republican governors to sign on. We've already seen in places, you know, and red states, places like Louisiana, that, you know, Republican politicians are willing to prioritize, you know, politics over health care for their constituencies. So that's a problem, particularly when Blacks and Latinos are 2 times more likely to be on Medicaid than whites, even though more whites overall are on Medicaid. It's also an uneven sort of victory in the sense that it doesn't, the Affordable Care Act, as far as I understand it, precludes the inclusion of undocumented immigrants. So undocumented immigrants can't receive any of the expanded, you know, Medicaid benefits, for example. And they're also excluded from even participating in the insurance exchanges. So they can't, even if they want to pay full price and participate in the insurance exchanges, they're prohibited from doing that as well. So, you know, in a place like New York City that has a significant poor population of color, you know, there's a lot of health inequality that remains after the green lighting of the Affordable Care Act.
But you think this is a beginning and something better may come out of this?
I definitely hope it's the beginning, and I hope it, you know, I really hope it's been a sort of wedge that has opened up another range of possibilities, and it certainly beats the alternatives, which would have been, you know, the Affordable Care Act being rejected, or, you know, down the road in 18 months, the alternative of having it repealed by a President Romney. I mean, we have definitely made a significant advance.
Well, Ms. Nelson, thank you very much for speaking about your book, about the Black Panther health activism, and also your perspective on socialized medicine in this country. And again, thank you very much. I will produce a 3-minute or 3.5-minute piece tomorrow. So
thank
maybe
you
could be on, and I'll send you a copy of it.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a nice
Bye-bye.
Day. Bye-bye.
You too.